Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, Ransom 79, the emotional documentary about Charlie Bird's last story. We talk about Piano Dreams, the new documentary by Gary Lennon about the Chinese student sacrificing so much to become the next big musical star. Plus, Niamh O'Reilly is here to talk about the new Mad Max movie and the new sci-fi movie on Netflix, Atlas, starring Jennifer Lopez. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. Good weekend to you all. I hope you're doing well. Just want to quickly mention, I was at Bruce Springsteen on Sunday in Crow Park. Hell of a gig, as it often is, but it was particularly good. Regular listeners know I'm a big fan and always go when he's here. So do half the country. This time I had child number one, 11, soon to be 12-year-old with me in hand. And it was great. He struggled a bit at the start, the noise, the overwhelm of it. And then by the end of it, he was dancing in the dark. And for a first gig, God, you can't get better than Bruce. And, you know, he said to me at one point during a song called The Rising, "You used to sing that to me as a kid." So it was kind of an emotional thing to be there, I have to say, if that's not oversharing. A great concert, it really was. And a lovely atmosphere in the crowd. There weren't that many children at it. And people kept coming up high-fiving my son. On two different occasions, people offered him sweets. And Bruce does long shows. And during the encore, someone came up and said to him, "You're nearly there, pal. Keep going." So it was a lovely atmosphere. Also, the most sober I've been at a gig in living memory. Because, you know, I find gigs now at my age, it's usually with my wife, or it's usually with a pal I haven't seen in a long time. So you tend to have a few beers just because you're away from life and you're catching up with people or whatever. So this was a sober one, which is a good way to do a gig. Well, that's a very Irish thing to say. I had one beer, so I wasn't actually no alcohol, but you know, nearly there. But anyway, Bruce was great. And ending with A Rainy Night in Soho was just beautiful. But listen, you're here for movies and TV shows. And this week in TV, I was watching this.
You have told him you're a drunk, right?
Well, I mean, I'm finally at a place in my life where I can say no. That's not good for me. I'm not going to go there. I'm an alcoholic. That's what I'm exploring in this piece. How one can be sober but still messy. Cheers.
Now that's a clip of season two of The Dry. We've spoken about season one last year from acclaimed director and fan of, well, we're fans of his. He may be a fan of this show. Paddy Branock and the writer Nancy Harris, all about Roisin Gallagher playing Shiv. A recovering alcoholic who is in therapy. Not therapy. She's in AA and she's back living with her parents. Her mum played Pam Boyd. Brilliant in this. And in season two, what happens is she's still negotiating sober life. Her mother is now dating a new man, having put her husband, Kieran Hines, into the shed in the bottom of their garden. And her new boyfriend, Michael McElhattan, is a jackass in this, who talks about being a man of letters all the time. What was great about season one is that it was a great dramedy, The Dry. It was very funny at times, but also nicely serious at times. And Shiv's, that's what they call her in the show, her, you know, attempt to stay sober. And it continues that. It's so funny and so sweet and heartfelt. I've watched four episodes, really, really enjoying it. And the cast, the other plots going on, as I say, with the mother and her father. And there's a new love interest. We still have Mo Dunford, her old love interest, in there as well. This is great. Irish-made TV, The Dry, season two, all episodes on the player now. Do yourself a favour, watch it. You will laugh, be entertained, you may even cry. That is The Dry on RTE. Let me know what you may have been watching. John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. And now we turn to the week's new movie releases, which this week include the new Mad Max movie, the fifth in the franchise, and a Netflix movie starring J-Lo, Jennifer Lopez, for those of you who aren't as cool as I am, on Netflix, which lands, both of them land this Friday, one in the cinema and one, of course, on a streaming device called Netflix. Niamh O'Reilly is in studio, corporeal form, having seen both of them. Hello, Niamh, how are you?
I'm great, how are you doing?
Very well. So listen, Furioso, a Mad Max saga, the fifth movie in the Mad Max franchise.
Hard to believe, isn't it?
Yeah. And Mel Gibson has played three of them. Tom Hardy did the fourth one.
That's right.
And I'm telling you all this like you don't know it, but this is for the benefit of listeners. And this one we have a female protagonist.
Yeah, so this is Furiosa, who you might remember from the previous film in 2015, Fury Road. But this is the story of, I suppose, her young life and how she came to be Furiosa. So it's set, I would say, maybe 15 to 20 years before the one in 2015.
Before Fury Road, which was a very good movie.
Really good. I mean, hard to beat fiction.
Yeah.
I mean, terrific.
And George Miller is at the helm in this one, as he has been on the previous four.
This is his baby. Mm. These are his passion projects. And it took him about, I think, 10 years to make this sequel. And apparently he has a prequel. And apparently he has two sequels that he would like to do. But like, he's turning 80,
yeah,
I think, next year. So he'd want, like, if he takes 10 years to do
two
more sequels, you know, I really want him to hurry up because I love these films, right, particularly the last two.
There was talk of him being a guest on this very show, but that didn't happen. But anyway, such
would've
is life.
Awesome.
Okay, so we have Furiosa. So this is, what's going on for her in this?
So basically we pick up and we see her as a young girl and she is in the green place of many mothers that we heard a lot about in Fury Road. She's basically kidnapped from there by some very gnarly, very nasty bikers who live out on the wasteland. She's taken prisoner, and she's brought to the warlord Dementus, who's played brilliantly by Chris Hemsworth. He's sporting a really gnarly fake nose and kind of Austin Powers.
You've said gnarly twice.
It's just so gnarly. And he's really hamming up the Aussie accent here. Like, he sounds a bit like Alf from Neighbours.
Okay.
He's like, Struth, you know. So I had to, like, take a double take. I knew it was him, but the prosthetics are very, very good. Mm. In any case, she's taken as his captive and he kind of takes a weird shine to her and almost takes her as his adopted daughter, which is kind of strange. But this is the wasteland. Everyone is strange. Everyone is diseased. Everyone is deformed, etc. So it's not really that strange for Mad Max.
Yeah.
So anyway, we fast forward a little bit in time. And Dementus has faced off against Immortan Joe, who you will remember from Fury Road. So he is the warlord of the Citadel and controls water and food.
Played by?
He's not played by the same actor time out. It's a different actor, but he looks very, very similar. They've done a really good job there. So they face off. And Dementus takes over Gastown, which you might remember from 2015. And they strike a deal to sort of coexist with one another. The deal breaker is that Immortan Joe gets Furiosa because, coming from the green place of many mothers, she's like genetically perfect. You know, she's not deformed or anything like that. So his plan is to take her, add her to his harem of brides, inverted commas, to eventually make more children for him. Thankfully, she's very, very resourceful. She breaks free of her chastity belt and kind of slips into the bowels of the Citadel unnoticed, dresses herself up as a boy and starts working down in the bowels where they are putting the war rig together, which you'll know all about if you've seen the other film, and lives sort of happily enough there and plots her revenge, basically, on Dementus and also to get back home to the green place.
So it's a road movie of sorts overstated?
Whereas Fury Road was sort of like this full-on, non-stop, in-your-face action road film. I mean, that's what it was. It was the good guys getting away from the baddies on Fury Road.
Yeah.
And that's all it was. It was in full caps, in your face, no punctuation.
Yeah.
Furiosa is different. I mean, it's still full caps, but there is punctuation here. There's commas, there's full stops. And it is broken up into five different chapters.
Okay.
And each one has sort of funny little names like the Pole of Inaccessibility and stuff like that.
Okay.
Like, makes no sense.
And who did you say plays Furiosa again?
Oh, it is Anya Taylor-Joy.
Yes, of course, Anya Taylor-Joy.
She does a terrific job here.
Yeah. So there's plenty of action, but it's the pause button has been hit slightly. So is it a successful Mad Max movie?
I think it is. I think people have said it's not as good as the 2015.
What does Niamh O'Reilly say?
I really, really liked this. Mm. And I like it because, for me, it was a great companion piece to that one. I didn't want more of the same.
Yeah.
I wanted to know more about Furiosa because she, I mean, unquestionably stole the film from Tom Hardy.
Mm.
You know, it was supposed to be a Mad Max film.
Yeah.
It was a Furiosa film.
Yeah.
And Anya Taylor-Joy is brilliantly cast here. Now, she lacks, obviously, the physicality of Charlize Theron, you know, who's like 6 foot one.
Yeah.
Was, you know, quite muscular
yeah,
in the
yeah.
film. So she's quite slight. But what she does have are, you know, these amazing eyes, very, very expressive.
Yes, she does.
Furiosa is a character who, I mean, her childhood has been completely stolen from her. She has seen the most horrific things nobody should ever see. And she almost uses silence as a weapon, as a superpower. Like she has very, very little dialogue in this film throughout.
Okay.
But she doesn't need dialogue.
Yeah.
She kind of conveys everything with looks and sort of body language. And learning about sort of where she came from and why she is such a tough customer.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed that. And I thought it added another layer of emotion to the film and enriched the 2015 film, which sometimes can be hard to do. Prequels, they don't always work out. You know, they sometimes diminish
yeah.
what's already there. But I found this was the opposite.
Okay. And they're often, you feel sometimes a waste of time, but this yeah. clearly wasn't a waste of time.
I as I said, I think it added so much. Mm. And for the people who liked the action of the first one, there's tons of it here.
And by the first one, you mean?
Sorry, 2015.
Yeah, 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 exactly.
There's tons of it here. But also, more than that, there's world building.
Mm.
So in 2015, we just really saw the Fury Road and we saw the Citadel. This time, George Miller is having a lot of fun. We see Gas Town, we see the Bullet Farm, we see the Green Place.
Mm.
So we get an idea of what's actually out there kind of in the wasteland. And you get the sense that perhaps he's sowing the seeds for these sequels and perhaps could look at other characters and broaden it out
okay.
a little bit more, which I really like. There's so much, it's such a bonkers story.
Yeah, yeah,
I mean,
I know.
Everybody is completely off the wall in this. Like, it's just, it is full on, you
yeah,
know?
But it's pleasingly off the wall. Now, I haven't seen it, but it does sound very good. So what are you going to say stars-wise for Furiosa, a Mad Max saga?
Like, I would almost say 5. But
wow.
I think I will steady on a little bit,
okay.
and I'm going to say a very strong 4.
A very strong yeah. 4. Okay, so let's take a quick clip.
Remember me?
You fabulous thing. You crawled out of a pitiless grave deeper than hell. Only one thing's going to do that for you. Not hope. Hate. No shame in hate. It's one of the great forces of nature. That wasn't hope, that was instinct.
That is a clip of Furiosa, a Mad Max saga, which Niamh O'Reilly gave a whopping 4 stars to and was teetering, I should say. She's tethered, teetering on 5 stars, but we managed to rein her in. Now, a new movie landing on Netflix this week, this Friday, the 24th of May, which I have seen, is Atlas, a sci-fi movie all about AI starring Jennifer Lopez. So tell us quickly, Niamh, what's going on in this?
Oh, God, just from the sublime to the ridiculous. I hate to be cruel, but this was not my cup of tea.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a story about AI, essentially.
Yeah.
So Jennifer Lopez plays Atlas Shepherd, a brilliant computer data analyst, very distrustful of AI. And it's set in the near future where AI has become like not just self-aware, but it has sort of become dangerous
yeah.
And tried to attack humans. Thankfully, that didn't happen. We stopped them from sort of taking over and destroying everybody. But there's kind of a tentative peace, I guess, because the leader of the AI has left the planet, but vowed to come back and sort of finish whatever he started. So now Jennifer Lopez is grown up, time has flashed forward, and she's kind of called into a mission to go and find this renegade.
Her mother having been instrumental in...
Yeah, well, yeah, I suppose that's not too much of a spoiler to give that away,
so.
But her mother was very heavily involved in AI
yeah.
and actually created this, Harlan is his name,
yeah.
Is kind of the leader of the AI. And I suppose he almost grew up as a semi-sibling to Jennifer Lopez's character Atlas. So she has a lot of skin in the game here.
Yeah. And she goes off to fight him in space, as you do.
Basically, in this sort of amazing big suit, which sort of pairs with her mind, the AI in it kind of pairs with her mind to create something not quite either of them, but something new.
Yes, indeed.
As they keep calling it.
So that's the premise, an AI sci-fi. You hated this then, did you?
I'm really sorry. And it's not that
don't apologise. That's why I pay you the big bucks.
That's why, I like sci-fi and I love films about AI. I think right now it's a really hot topic.
Yes,
you know?
It certainly is.
But this cherry picks or rips off every film that has ever been made about robots or AI or space. I mean, I stopped counting, but there was rip-offs from Terminator 2, 2001, Minority Report, iRobot, and a direct scene from Alien 3, if you'll remember, where Bishop's head is rebooted. I mean, practically scene for scene. I get that you take influences from other films that you like. And
they're wearing them a bit too much on their sleeve.
But this was too blatant. Yeah. And the script didn't hold up. It was just full of cliches. It didn't ring true. There was no, the sort of emotion they were trying to convey between Jennifer Lopez and this AI called Smith that she sort of reluctantly has to join up with.
Yeah.
There was kind of, they were trying to lay that on very thin. Mm. There was no emotion to be had there. It all, I mean, it's a 2-hour film, but it felt rushed. And I just didn't care. At the end, I really suppose.
Can I, devil's advocate of a sort, I didn't hate it as much as you. I found it kind of mindless escapism. Mm. And I, once in a while, I thought they were trying to make some interesting idea about what's actually the difference between AI and human consciousness, but it doesn't come off at all. But maybe it's just, you know, she's been a darling and a demon of the tabloids for so long. I just think Jennifer Lopez wasn't bad in it, but maybe it's the material just wasn't up to her.
I think that's fair. I think it was just the material wasn't up to it. She's not a bad actress.
No, not at all.
She put in some really good performances. Yeah. And can I just say, Mark Strong and Sterling K. Brown are also in this.
Yeah, I know.
Extremely fine actors.
Very underwritten pieces
like,
for them.
They may as well not have been in it.
I know.
That was total gaslighting. I thought, oh, well, if they're in it, it's got to be all right, you know? But like, the really a warning sign for me was that Mark Strong smiled in this. He never smiles in films. He's always quite serious.
We're in trouble if Mark Strong is happy.
If he smiles, get out of there.
Yeah. So what are you going to say stars-wise for Atlas?
Look, I tried to find some redeeming qualities in it. I think the little bit of banter between Jennifer Lopez's character Atlas and the AI Smith, I did elicit a little laugh every now and then. Mm. So I think a very generous. I'd be very generous if I said 2.
Yeah, okay. Fair enough. Well, I'd give a 2 as well for what it's worth. That is 2 for Atlas, now streaming on Netflix. But if it's a choice between Atlas and Furiosa, a Mad Max saga, it is definitely the former that Niamh O'Reilly is opting for. Niamh, thank you.
Thanks, Emil.
Up next, Charlie Bird's Last Scoop. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. Now, a big new Irish release this week is Ransom 79, which follows iconic Irish reporter and now sadly late Charlie Bird as he hunts down his last story while struggling with motor neuron disease. In 2021, Bird got another in a long line of scoops, the Garda file of a secret operation to foil a ransom threat from 1979, where a criminal gang threatened to destroy the Irish economy by releasing foot and mouth disease into the national herd unless it was paid a staggering £5 million. But even as Bird started to investigate, he noticed the first symptoms of what would turn out to be a fatal diagnosis. Determined to keep following the story, Bird recruits journalist and writer and I guess friend Colin Murphy to help. Together they crisscross the country, chasing down leads, interviewing former guards and politicians, including Bertie Ahern, and attempting to find the gang, all the while Charlie's condition is deteriorating. The director of Ransom 79 is Colm Quinn, and I'm delighted to say he joins me now. Colm, hi, how are you?
Hey, John, how's it going?
Very well. So, Colm, my understanding of this is this first came to light for you when you heard Charlie talk about it in a podcast, this kind of intriguing story about this rattlebag of kind of extreme nationalists who were trying to get £5 million quid off the government.
Yeah, that's right, John. Yeah, a couple of years ago now, there was a podcast that Charlie produced that sort of laid out the groundwork, so to speak, for what would ultimately become the documentary Ransom 79. But the podcast was absolutely fascinating in that, like, all of the kind of the core elements, like the letters and the ads and, you know, insight from agricultural perspectives and, you know, insight from the guards and, Charlie Source, four goals, Willie McGee, former head of the Garda Fraud Squad. They all contributed to the podcast, and it made for a riveting listen. And it was actually the producer of Ransom 79, John Keller, got on to me, and he said Charlie had done this really excellent podcast, so I had a listen. We met up with Charlie, and Charlie was just really enthusiastic to pursue it and to dive into the investigation even further in the interests of a documentary. So that was 3 years ago now, and that was a couple of months before Charlie would have received the diagnosis for motor neuron. So obviously that then changed things a bit, and we actually ended up making a different documentary at the time. That was Charlie wanted to do something around, I guess, processing the magnitude of the diagnosis that he had received. And we ended up making a documentary for RTÉ called Charlie Word Loud and Clear. And that sort of dealt with Charlie was losing his voice, sadly, as part of the condition. And his wife, Claire, was putting together a series of his voice samples so that he could put together a voice bank that would allow him to communicate via iPad after he lost his voice. So we charted that in the Loud and Clear documentary, up as far as the famous climb on Crowpatrick, when Charlie got half the country out climbing their local mountains and stuff. So we did all that actually before then coming back to Ransom. And it's to Charlie's credit that even after making that documentary, he still wanted to do Ransom while dealing with the awful symptoms of motor neuron disease, you know. So yeah, that was where it all started.
What comes across in the film is that, but you can tell me that wanting to tell this story, you know, Charlie is going through, you know, a maelstrom of despair at times, and why wouldn't he? But that this story about this ransom demand was kind of giving him purpose.
Yeah, that's exactly it, John. Yeah, it was remarkable when we first started to film material for Ransom 79, we were putting together a promo, and we did a couple of interviews. And in those interviews, you could really see Charlie engaging with the interviewees via the voice bank and really putting the voice bank through its paces. As interviewees would be answering, Charlie would be typing away, you know, and really directing the conversation. So he had the option to preload questions into the voice bank, but you know, rarely would an interview sort of follow those set questions. It would, you know, he would follow the conversation as such, and where the interesting sort of ideas led, I suppose, you know. And I guess it was seeing just the body language from Charlie, just the level of interaction he had in those interviews, the level of deep engagement, and just you could see just how into them he was, you know. And it was, and as you say, like the symptoms were obviously very difficult, and you know, that was the thing. Like, against the backdrop of motor neuron, he was still able to find that, as you say, that sense of purpose, you know, through his work, which was it was a privilege to document that, you know.
I can imagine. And just, you know, I don't want to give it away because it's a fascinating story, but the ransom demand, you have this gang who basically write to the Department of Agriculture, say, give us, like, I don't mean to laugh, but it is like something out of a movie, you know, if that's not too meta, where they send letters saying, we're going to release foot and mouth disease unless you give us 5 million quid. And then they say they want responses in the Irish Times. So you have the government, in essence, writing back to these criminals in adverts in the back of the Irish Times. I mean, the story is just crazy.
Absolutely gas, and I think that was the thing. Charlie was amazed that he hadn't heard anything about this, you know, utterly, utterly outlandish caper, you know. And as you say, the back and forth is, you know, like something out of a Le Carre novel or something like that, you know. Yeah. It's absolutely fascinating. And the thing as well, like the gang continued to up the stakes over the course of each of the letters as well, you know. So it was that sort of gave the story a sort of a natural sort of structure and jeopardy built into it as well, because it was like they outlined their demands, and then the ransom number went up, and Then there was the strategy kind of going on from the guard side in terms of like trying to delay and buy time. Absolutely fascinating sort of back and forth between the guards and the gang.
Yeah, and you get great people. You get former IRA people talking, former guards, former Taoiseach. I guess it helps when you have probably Ireland's best known reporter on the case, so to speak, that doors may be open to you a bit.
Yeah, yeah. No, the Charlie contact book played a huge role in all this for sure. And, you know, Charlie and Colin together, they put together a fantastic list of interviewees to really give a sense of the period and to, you know, give insight on all the different aspects of the story from a political point of view and then from a scientific point of view. And then, you know, there's voices from the guards giving us insight there. And then we have a forensic psychiatrist. And, you know, like the story is sort of approached from so many different angles and dissected. Yeah. Via all these different voices, and it was just fascinating to watch those interactions between those contributors and Charlie and Paul.
Yeah, and without giving any spoiler, like there's a very good dramatic recreation of kind of where it all goes to, and there's a great who done it or who didn't do it, but people will have to watch it themselves to see. But one thing on that just occurred to me, like in 1979, I was only four, so I don't have that vivid memories of that time. But what your documentary really brings across, I mean, through the investigations and through Charlie, is that like that time in Ireland, you know, I mean, Bob Geldof had been writing about banana republics at that time. And I don't want to say it was a banana republic, but it was a crazy time. Like, it occurs to me where, in a way, the state was, it's a miracle we didn't, I don't know, be taken over by someone or we didn't go bankrupt. I mean, I was really struck by just what a Mad Hatter time 1979 was.
Yeah, yeah, no, you're right. It's I'm similar to you in that I actually wasn't even born in 79. I was 81 when I was born. So it was it's one of those things.
We're both on the back nine now, Colin. But anyway,
very much so, John. Yeah, it was that's the thing when we dived into the research on this. It was actually incredible to get that sense of the period and. And like you say, you know, like the overall context, you know, with the troubles in the north and, you know, the potential that it could boil over into the south and, you know, all these various kind of gangs running around doing mad things, robbing banks. You know, I think Bertie Ahern has a line in the film where there was barely a Friday went by where there wasn't a bank robbery. you know, the context was of, yeah, very, very sort of dangerous times.
Well, look, the documentary is great in that regard, but obviously, you know, there's two strands to it, I suppose, and they're both very much intertwined. There's obviously this crazy ransom story, but there is Charlie in the throes of this diagnosis. I mean, it's very emotional at times, and there's one point, you know, he's talking to Colin and it's near the end, and you know, Charlie basically has something along the lines of there's days I don't want to be here. I don't want to keep doing this. And he's not just talking about the documentary. He's clearly talking about living. I mean, it must have been, those scenes must have been very emotional to be filming.
They were, John. Yeah. Yeah. They were very emotional to film. And I think that was the thing in terms of Charlie and Colin's relationship. You know, like Colin had that sort of, you know, deep empathy, and Charlie felt very comfortable in that context and in being able to speak about what he was experiencing with the symptoms and just, you know, some of those thoughts that were going through his head. So yeah, I mean, it was there were some very, very difficult moments along the way for sure, you know. I think that was the thing. It was like, it was as Charlie says to Colin as well, at one point, I think they're in the car, and I think he alludes to the fact that the story is keeping him alive, you know. And the interesting thing about this process, and just, I suppose, it kind of harks back to the earlier point, is that, you know, I think there was a real sense of kind of purpose and meaning that Charlie was getting from the very telling of this story, you know, the being present for interviews and the engaging with people and, you know, and I mean, there was obviously, you know, I mean, that was just one part all of the things that Charlie wanted to do with the time he had left. Like, he did an awful lot of charity work for causes he felt very deeply about, and obviously, you know, he has a great family who are so supportive. And it was a privilege to spend time in Charlie's company.
Sure.
Just while he was following this story with just all of the difficulties that were going on.
Well, look, it is a fitting testament to him. And just finally, like, obviously the movie's out this Friday, the 24th of May. We know Charlie passed away earlier in the year. But my understanding is he did get to see some version of a final cut.
That's right. Yeah. Colin went over one evening and showed Charlie one of the... We had a pretty advanced cut at that stage, and we had actually just shot a bunch of reconstructions and just got them into the cut. So he thankfully he got to see something that was very well advanced. And we did a little video call afterwards where he was very emotional about what he had seen, and he was, you know, giving it a thumbs up, and you know, he was delighted with what he saw, and it was nice to have that moment for sure.
Well, look, Ransom 79, as I say, is in cinemas this Friday, the 24th of May. It is a fitting tribute and indeed a fascinating story to, well, Ireland's most pioneering journalist, you could say, the late, great Charlie Bird. I've been talking to its director, Colm Quinn. Colm, thanks a million.
Thanks, John.
I've got a lead on a story that I'd like to cover with you. It's a great day for investigative reporting, and it's a great day for public service broadcasting. It's about a ransom demand on the government that's been kept secret for more than 40 years.
I just ran. I couldn't believe it.
This story asks new questions about an era that shaped who I would become.
Charlie Bird in Ground Zero.
And it will be my last.
I need to tell you about my health. My motor neuron is moving to my limbs.
I'm working with Charlie Bird on a case from 1979.
Dear Minister,
there was the ransom demand for £5 million.
If you do this, we shall not introduce to this country one of the most deadly diseases that could afflict any country.
A clip there from Ransom 79, and you heard me talking to its director, Colm Quinn. And it's in, my colleague Sue Murphy reliably informs me, 40 screens. So that's plenty. So they say select, but that's a lot of select cinemas. So that is Ransom 79, about the late, great Charlie Bird, and indeed his last scintillating story that he followed. Up next, Piano Dreams. Now you're listening to Screen Time News Talks TV and Movie Show. Now, Piano Dreams is a new documentary that is released in select cinemas this Friday, the 24th of May. There are currently 40 million piano students in China, with many practicing up to 10 hours a day. Piano mania, as it's being called, has truly gripped the nation. In Piano Dreams, we follow three young hopefuls, aged respectively 8, 12 and 19, and their dedicated families as they chase their dreams in the ultra-competitive world of piano education. This is both an intimate portrait of a remarkably talented group of young musicians and a glimpse into the lives of the new Chinese middle class, their aspirations and the serious sacrifices and their sheer drive to succeed. All of this was directed by an Irish man called Gary Lennon, and I'm delighted to say he joins me now. Hi Gary, how are you?
Great, John, thank you.
So listen, very obvious place to start, but I have to. How did an Irishman end up making a documentary about Chinese piano students?
Yeah, I can't really tell you the exact reason why I decided to move to China, but it got into my head and I moved over there in 2000. And I happened to live next door to the Shanghai Music Conservatory. So every single day that I would open my window, and literally any time from 6 a.m. till midnight, I'd hear the sounds of piano coming through. So very obvious to me, it was that this was a massively competitive, massively passionate group of musicians. But then also, when you went to any apartment block in Shanghai, you would see advertisements for piano lessons. And I was talking to my Chinese friends who had children of this age, and all of them just had this obsession with learning pianos. And I suppose the interesting question from the outside looking in is why?
The three children, well, one of them, two of them are teenagers, one's a young adult, I suppose. I don't want to butcher their names, but they are wonderful examples, I suppose, of what we're talking about, these dedicated students. The first little boy, you can tell me his name, he kind of reminded me of like a young Billy Joel or something like that. But what they, and I suppose it's obvious, but what the three of them have in common is despite, you know, how much their parents are keen for them to do this, they are amazing. I know a small bit about playing the piano, but they are incredible piano players in all three of them. How did you find these three?
Yeah, so the youngest character is called Shah Jadi, and he's a remarkable little guy who we all kind of fell in love with on the production. Our initial... You know, there's so many Chinese piano students. You know, the number there of 40 million, it could describe it as 80 million, you know, people that are training to a high level. So that's the population of Germany when you put it into context.
Yeah.
But we found these largely through two sources. One of them was the Shanghai Music Conservatory itself. And then we also got very close to the two kind of leading teachers there, the head of the conservatory and one of the professors, Professor Tang. And she had a private school, so that allowed us to meet about 50 of these really exceptional students in an exceptional school. And then the other place that we found characters, and this is where we found Shah Jidi, the younger guy who you referred to, was going to competitions. So we'd go to competitions and we'd see who kind of stood out, and then we'd hang out with them and see if they had something about them. And quite quickly, we all kind of just fell for Shah because he was a little bit funnier. He was a little bit kind of more open and more engaging. A lot of the Chinese piano students would be quite introverted and just extremely driven. So this is what jumped out about him. And another big thing was his family were just so nice. You know, they were a gorgeous family. His granny, you know, he sleeps with his granny every night. She makes all his food and dinner. You know, she's just a lovely family, and they really welcomed us into their house. So that was kind of the reasons we went for him.
And, you know, his piano teacher, like, it's funny, you know, my wife watched it with me and, you know, and we were both kind of the opinion, you know, for want of a better phrase, he's a bit of a prick to him. I mean, he's threatening to slap him at one point. And then as it went on, I could see that they had a real bond and he's walking the streets with him and he's play acting with him. I mean, what's your sense of his piano teacher? Because certainly at times he's borderline cruel to him.
Yeah. Well, I would say a couple of things. Another reason that we really went for this character was his teacher. And most piano teachers are that kind of, you know, very conservative, prim and proper type, where this guy, he's more of a sports coach, isn't he, than a piano teacher. Like he roughhouses him a bit and shakes him and things like that. I would very much say that it is a cultural difference there, and that, you know, depending on how old you are, like I'm in my mid-40s, I was smacked by loads of teachers in my younger years. But if you were to do that to Irish students nowadays, it's just not allowed. Whereas in China, that is kind of allowed still, you know, if you were to do that. I'm not saying that's widespread, but people certainly wouldn't be giving out the way that an Irish parent would here for the same type of thing. But it is really important to say how he is a part of the family. You know, he stays with them. He goes out with them. He goes on holidays with them. He's with their son for hours and hours a day. He sees them much more than the parents. So, and he's really kind of like, he's on his coattails. He's hoping that this guy will be the next Lang Lang, the next Chinese prodigy. And he's hoping that this will be the springboard for his piano school to be the most famous in its area.
And then if we jump ahead to the eldest boy, young man, he's 19, again, a brilliant piano player. In terms of the sacrifice these guys and these families make, like his mother had him on an overnight train to Shanghai and back in one weekend. Like the level of sacrifice that goes into this piano tuition, like it's hard to fathom in a way.
It really is, yeah. Yuang is his name. And Yuang. It's also it kind of... We chose them at the different ages that they are because it shows a real clear difference in the kind of development and progression of China. So when he was a boy, you know, there was no high-speed trains in those days. So as you say, his mum came from the distance of, you know, Paris to Dublin for one two-hour train piano lesson. And then they would get an overnight slow train back to their province And they would do that every single weekend until eventually they made the leap and moved to Shanghai. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the levels, you know, it's just a remarkable level of sacrifice that would cause a parent to do that. And I suppose the other thing I would like to say is that they're not all just trying to, you know, they're not like tennis dads, you know, that are trying to make a fortune out of their children's success. Yeah. They're really just supporting the children's dreams. Like over the course of the film, it really comes clear that it's the children that are driving this and the families are supporting them. And the sacrifice that the families, and in particular the mothers, you know, the mothers leave their hometowns, they leave their jobs, they leave their friends.
They leave their husbands in some cases.
And they leave their husbands and they set up in an apartment in Shanghai just so they can get the best piano tuition. So it's really just a breathtaking sacrifice.
You mentioned the tennis dad thing, and you know, there's this famous trope that entered the lexicon maybe 20 years ago at this stage, the tiger mother, and that's seen as an Asian thing. But like, I get what you're saying about it's the children's desire and they're just, you know, helping them manifest their dreams. But it does seem kind of uniquely Asian and uniquely Chinese, the level of dedication. I mean, in Ireland or England or America, there isn't this plethora of such devout music students, I don't think, certainly not in those numbers. Like, is there something, like, what's in the water there? Or maybe it's too big a question to answer.
No, this is something that I absolutely kind of dived into and did all types of research and spoke to, you know, dozens and hundreds of people about it. I think there's a couple of big reasons that you can say. And first of all is that China has seen the power of a Hollywood and America's soft power. And they have decided that classical music is a non-political way that they could possibly do this. So they've set up loads of music conservatories. They've been very supportive of concerts. If you go to a piano concert in China, you know, there's children 7 and 8 and 9 and 10 dancing like the way that people do at pop music concerts here in the West. So I think that's one element of it. And I think that secondly, you know, for parents who have these children, the China that they grew up in is just so different to what their children have. They're actually, it's piano playing is the ultimate sign of urban sophistication and cosmopolitanism.
So that's,
you know, we saw this happen in Korea in the, you know, the 80s and Japan in the 70s. So it has that. But for me, a really big thing is, and it was kind of said to me kind of off camera a little bit and at kind of quieter moments of reflection, and that is, you know, China's such a heavily controlled country, you know, by their government. And also, you know, the images that we saw of China, you know, in kung fu movies, you know, these beautiful old buildings and, you know, bamboo forests. But China is not like that at all. China is like a massive building site with 170 cities with more than 1 million people in it. So against that, Chinese people are incredibly cultured and they have the longest culture in the world. And piano playing and indoor piano playing allows them to find beauty in the world in their country that has all of these restrictions and all of these environmental damage and noise pollution and things like that. And it's a little oasis, in my opinion, for Chinese people, where they are able to find beauty without any restrictions by government or legislation.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what else I thought about the movie? And this is a bit of a non sequitur or something like that, but the meal times look delightful. And you talk about, you know, finding escape in music and these terror blocks and stuff, but food, there's a lot in your movie where everyone's sitting down to eat together and the food looks gorgeous. I don't know if you added extra green sheen to the vegetables in post-production, but the food looks beautiful. But again, the ceremony of food seems to be almost similar to the ceremony of music, or that was just my take on it.
No, food is the single most important thing in Chinese culture. And we really wanted to show that. And it's great that you kind of picked up on that. You know, Chinese people show their love by providing good food. You can see how that is. It's also how the family socializes together. And even the style of eating, you know, it's shared bowls and dishes. Yeah. It's not each person with a plate of food. It's just the same. And also, you know, it's just what they love doing. When you talk to Chinese people at lunchtime, their question is what are you having for dinner? But that is, you know, it's an obsession that if, you know, much more so than French or Italian people, you know, it is the single most important thing for them. But it's also, we wanted to show it because it's the only other thing that they do in their lives. You know, when they're not practicing piano, they're sitting around the table eating with their family, And this is kind of their life. You know, it's a very indoor life. It's food, piano, or, you know, as the girl Ying Ying says, you know, it's eat, sleep, piano. You know?
Yeah.
That's their lives at the moment.
Ying Ying, of course, that's the girl in question. Well, listen, we're sadly out of time, Gary, but it is an eye-opening, delightful documentary and, you know, thought-provoking as well. And of course, it goes without saying, there is gorgeous music in it as well. I've been talking to the director of Piano Dreams, Gary Lennon, and as I say, it's in select cinemas from this Friday, the 24th of May. Gary, thanks a million.
Thank you.
Gary Lennon there, the director of Piano Dreams, talking to me. I wasn't able to play a clip of that for you because it's all in Chinese. I could play you like some Chopin music. There's a lot of, I think it's Chopin. It's classical. And but, you know, that would be a bit random. But it's a great watch, a fascinating story about just how intense the practice schedule is and the desire to be a professional piano player in China. That is also in select cinemas from this Friday, the 24th of May. That is it for this week. Next week on the show, Benedict Cumberbatch and also Matthew Modine. So a busy week on the show next week, but that's all next week. In the meantime, if you would like to get in touch with me at any stage, you can email me screentime@newstalk.com or you can tweet me John_Fardy. If you want to listen back to this show, go to the News Talk player or the News Talk app powered by Go Loud or wherever you get your podcast and download it and tell your friends to download it or just stream it. Just press play and listen once and keep listening. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the remainder of your weekend and I'll talk to you all next week.